And then the next stuff, thanks to Matt, his first time like leading worship on his own, and Lorna, who helped plan the service. It's really nice to be able to kind of hand them a topic and have them come up with different elements and ways to engage that. And so I think they're doing a great job personally, but it's a nice, yeah. So thanks. Before getting into teaching time, I'd actually like to do what we've been doing this past month or so and just open up a little time for prayer. All right. We are going to be continuing our series on John, and today I'm just going to try to couple of topics. Just sheep, shepherds, gates, wolves, hired hands, thieves, outlaws, strangers, fathers, and sons. So this should be pretty easy. As you probably noticed, if you've been around with us during this series on John, you've probably noticed that John tells Jesus' story in a fairly unique way. Sometimes complementing the stories that we've heard in other versions, sometimes it seems John is assuming that you've heard some of the other stories and he wants to tell us new ones, things that give us different perspectives on Jesus' life. But one of the major things you may have noticed is that whereas the Synoptic Gospels have Jesus speaking almost entirely, a lot of times in parables, you know, these pithy little stories and sayings, John doesn't have him really tell any of those. On the other hand, though, John does have Jesus speaking in an abundance of metaphors and imagery in order to talk about God, himself, and his mission, God's people, and a myriad of other topics. And these function often similarly to the way that the parables function in the Synoptic Gospels. We've talked about some of these already along the way, light and dark as indicators of understanding or belief, or lack thereof, bread and wine as metaphors for Jesus' body and blood. And we've talked some about the different ways that come up today, the images of shepherd and father, but I'm going to try to approach them in a little bit of a different way than we have before. Oops, I'm supposed to be doing this. In keeping with the kind of idea of the two horizons that we've been interpreting and behind, I want to talk about good metaphors and images as having both a timely element and some timelessness to them, meaning that they fit well in the context in which they're originally used, and I want to take some time exploring that, but also that good images, good metaphors retain some lasting significance over time and in contexts that are incredibly different from the original. So we're going to look at the first part of John chapter 10, but I'm going to hop ahead a little bit just to give some kind of reassurance, I guess. Because John 10 verse 6 says, those who heard Jesus use this analogy, these analogies, didn't understand what he was saying. If it's fairly confusing, don't worry. You're in good company, along with all the people who heard Jesus speaking. These metaphors get kind of mixed up, tangled up in some different ways, and so if it comes a little difficult at first, don't worry about that. They didn't get it either. All right, so I'm going to go ahead and read from John 10. I assure you, this is Jesus speaking, I assure you that whoever doesn't enter into the sheep pen through the gate, but climbs over the wall is a thief and an outlaw. The one who enters through the gate is the shepherd of the sheep. The guard at the gate opens the gate for him, and the sheep listen to his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. Whenever he has gathered all of his sheep, he goes before them, and they follow him, because they know his voice. They won't follow a stranger, but will run away, because they don't know the stranger's voice. Those who heard Jesus use this analogy didn't understand what he was saying. So Jesus spoke again. I assure you that I am the gate of the sheep. All who come before me were thieves and outlaws, but the sheep didn't listen to them. I am the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief enters only to steal, kill, and destroy. But I came so that they could have life. Indeed, so that they could live life to the fullest. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. When the hired hand sees the wolf coming, he leaves the sheep and runs away. That's because he isn't the shepherd. The sheep aren't really his. So the wolf attacks the sheep and scatters them. He's only a hired hand, and the sheep don't matter to him. But I am the good shepherd. I know my own sheep, and they know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father. I give up my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that don't belong to this sheep pen. I must lead them too. They will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock with one shepherd. This is why the Father loves me. I give up my life so that I can take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I give it up because I want to. I have the right to give it up, and I have the right to take it up again. I received this commandment from my Father. There was another division among the Jews because of Jesus' words. Many of them said, "He has a demon and has lost his mind. Why listen to him?" Others said, "These aren't the words of someone who has a demon. Can a demon heal the eyes of the people who are blind?" That little bit, in case that's a little confusing, is coming from John 9, which is Ron taught on that. So this is following immediately Jesus' healing of a man who was born blind. And instead of addressing some of the questions that the leaders are raising about that healing, Jesus goes into these analogies and metaphors. So I want to address first how these parables were timely in Jesus' own context, how they might have been heard by the people who were listening to Jesus that day. And then we'll try to sort through some of the ways that these images and metaphors might also be timeless by bringing them into our own context. So one of the ways that, or one of the things that makes these some great images and metaphors is that both have really deep roots in Hebrew scriptures and theology. The imagery of God as a shepherd and of God's people as sheep is all throughout the Old Testament. For instance, in Isaiah 40, verse 11, it says, "Like a shepherd, God will tend the flock. He will gather lambs in his arms and lift them onto his lap. He will gently guide the nursing ewes." Throughout the Psalms, Psalm 78, 79, 95, 100, 119, all address God as a shepherd and speak of Israel, God's people, as sheep. But God isn't the only one thought of as a shepherd. When Moses is getting ready to hand off leadership of God's people to Joshua, he talks about it in terms of a shepherding metaphor. I don't have these up here, I'm sorry. I'll just read them. In Numbers 27, it says, "Moses spoke to the Lord, 'Let the Lord, the God of all living things, appoint someone over the community who will go out before them and return before them, someone who will lead them out and bring them back so that the Lord's community won't be like a sheep without their shepherd.'" So kind of referring to himself as the person who's been the shepherd for some time, but asking that God will appoint someone else to play that role. Moses and Aaron in the Psalms are both referred to as shepherds of God's people. And then there's also and David is the one primarily. David, before he became king of Israel, was an actual shepherd. And when he becomes king, that imagery gets applied to him. In 2 Samuel 5, all the Israelite tribes come to David at Hebron and say, "Listen, we are your very own flesh and bone. In the past, when Saul ruled over us, you were the one who led Israel out to war and back. What's more, the Lord told you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel. You will be Israel's leader.'" And some of the Psalms even have God talking about being the shepherd, but handing off that role to David and how well David does in that role. At different times in the prophets especially, false leaders and false prophets are referred to as shepherds, that they have led the sheep of Israel astray, and God is rebuking them for that. Another person who gets referred to as a shepherd in Isaiah is Cyrus, the Persian king who is doing God's work to some extent without knowing that he is a part of God's plan for Israel. And then there's kind of this great passage, I'm not going to read it all now, but in case you want to go look it up later, in Ezekiel 34, the shepherd and sheep imagery comes to a point, and it is sort of an all-in-one. So the false leaders who are acting as shepherds fail, so God takes the flock back from them as their shepherd, but promises to hand them back over to another appointed shepherd like David, someone who will come from the line of David. So if you want to read a ton of that imagery and metaphor, read Ezekiel 34. But this imagery would have been somewhat familiar because it had such deep roots in the people who were hearing its thought. The same is true of the father and son metaphor. God and the nation of Israel as a whole are referred to as a parent and children. God's actions with the nation of Israel are often referred to in terms of a father's relationship with his children. Another aspect of these parables, images that kind of are like the parable, is that both of these images are incredibly familiar in everyday kind of way. These aren't esoteric or abstract ideas or concepts that people would have had to think about a lot to grasp. Everyone who was listening to Jesus probably at least knew one shepherd family where a father was getting ready to hand down the care of his flock to his son. And it might have even been the case, as we've talked about sometimes, that Jesus is gesturing over to, you know, look at these shepherds, look at these sheep, and allowing people to actually see something depending on where he's teaching from. And so I kind of want to paint, since that is not as much of a familiar, everyday, ordinary image, I kind of want to paint a picture of what might have happened in the life of a shepherding family. And this is based a lot on a great scholar that we refer to fairly often named Kenneth Bailey, who actually died fairly recently, but whose work draws on his time spent with actually different Middle Eastern people groups, particularly shepherds, and noting a lot of the ways that culture hadn't changed over the past 2,000 years, the ways that they still carried on a lot of traditions and stuff, and being able to draw analogies back to the first century because of that. And so he is a big part of kind of informing this kind of picture that I'm going to try to paint. A first century shepherding family might have had a flock of 100 sheep or so. Their whole livelihood would have been dependent on this flock. When the weather is good, the parts of the year that there's rain and cooler weather, they would have been able to take the sheep out during the day to nearby pastures to graze and bring them back at night into the main sheep pen. But when the dry season would hit, the shepherd would have to take the sheep elsewhere, maybe along with his son, maybe with hired hands if his flock was big enough. And along with other local shepherds and their flocks, they would have traveled away to valleys or fertile areas where there was still water and grass to graze on. In those areas, they would have had to build temporary sheep pens to hold all the sheep. And overnight, to keep predators away, one of the shepherds themselves might have laid down in the doorway of those pens. And in the morning, the shepherds would then call out their various sheep, sometimes by name if their flocks were small enough, and take them out to graze until they could return home. And so that kind of pattern was such a regular part of everyday life for the people that Jesus is speaking to, that's the kind of images, those are the kinds of things, and like I said, they probably very likely knew someone by name who carried out that pattern every year as the weather changed, as their flocks grew or shrunk, did that in some form or another. Another way that these images and metaphors spoke to the context that Jesus is speaking into is that he's specifically trying to answer questions that the Pharisees, like I said, raised in particularly in chapter 9 about who Jesus is and what Jesus is doing, right? And particularly Jesus' relationship to God. And it's interesting because the way that Jesus is going to use these metaphors, talking earlier about their roots in Hebrew scripture, is not totally discontinuous. It's not entirely different from the way that the scriptures spoke of David, of Cyrus, of these different people, that people could function and be understood as God's appointed shepherds or as God's sons or children. But it's not totally continuous with those ways of talking either. There seems to be something new about the way Jesus is referring to himself. There's a new way of being God's appointed shepherd, God's son. Jesus is taking on the shepherding role directly and seems to claim a unique firstborn place among the children of God. These images were also trying to carry a certain message with them. In each part of the parable, you'll notice that they kind of speak to a different situation or something that would have been around them. In the first part, Jesus is speaking out against the people like the prophets did, who Jesus perceived as false leaders, maybe other messianic pretenders of his time. And it seems especially he's focused on the leaders of the movements that became violent, that Jesus is speaking against these people as false shepherds who have the potential to lead Israel, God's people, astray. Jesus talks about sheep and shepherds in a way that says how a person would respond to God's offer of true and good life was demonstrated in how they would respond to Jesus. Part of the metaphor is trying to tell people that Jesus would ultimately lay down his life for Israel, both because he believed God had called him to do so, but also freely and of his own will. And overall, the metaphor seems to be telling the hearers and reminding us that Jesus knows and loves his followers intimately, wanted to gather other people in from other sheep pens, maybe people groups, maybe just groups of people who hadn't heard about Jesus yet or hadn't begun to follow him. And Jesus cares deeply about these people as well and wants them, in the way that Ron talked about following last week, just to be with him and to be with God through him. We notice later on in chapter 10 that these images and metaphors must have had a pretty clear and direct message to the people who are listening, because later on in chapter 10, those listening will attempt to stone Jesus. And when that seems to fail kind of mysteriously, at least to arrest him. And so we have to assume that as much as, you know, these images kind of sound nice to us, that they had kind of an edge to them, that they got under the skin of some of the wrong people, and these are the people who are going to be pursuing Jesus through the rest of the gospel. But I want to spend most of our time talking about the ways that these images and metaphors are timeless, the timelessness that they carry with them. Because over the past 2,000 years, we've come to understand how fluid language can be. As we learn more about ancient languages, how languages change over time, how many different ways language can even be used in the same context, and so on. And so I think it's important to acknowledge that these images and metaphors might not always stick with us the way that they stuck with their original hearers. They might still have some things to teach us, and they may, at their best, even prompt fresh ways of thinking about using our own language to develop new ways to talk about God, new images and metaphors that help us grasp God's role in our life. We have to be kind of careful because God talk is always approximate. It's always borrowed from different areas of our life, different things that we see around us that we try to apply to God. And it's always getting at something that we're trying to talk about, but it's never quite getting it. This is why I believe theology has to be kind of flexible. Even if our theology tells us that God never changes, the other part of the word, language, logic, reason, definitely change. And so we have to be able to be a little bit flexible to adapt to the ways that people are talking about things now, the things that we see and experience around us. Because both of these metaphors and images that Jesus uses in this passage have such strong connotations, I want to spend a little time addressing their limits, the ways that they might not be helpful of talking about or thinking of God anymore. But I definitely want to ask the question alongside of that of how they might still speak to us, how they might be brought fresh into our current context, how they still carry meaning for us in our relationships with God. Oops, that's that part. Okay. So the shepherds, sheep, gates, thieves metaphor as a whole, it's a limit that I want to kind of address, and I think is the easiest critique of this particular metaphor, is that we simply live in a society in which husbandry is much less common than it was in Jesus' day. Whereas then, everybody probably knew a shepherd. I doubt that many of us do. And so this metaphor is a little less tangible. It lacks that everyday quality. At the same time, I think that it might open the door to some new ways of thinking about God, to make sure that we understand God as actively involved in our everyday lives, not just as an abstract concept or an ancient idea that belongs to 2,000 years ago, that we might find an equally everyday ways of talking about, thinking about, and especially experiencing God in our lives. To break that metaphor down a little bit further, shepherds have some interesting connotations. The one limit that I want to especially point out is it has a strong gender connotation. There simply weren't female shepherds in the first century. And that also applies to the father-son thing. I just want to say that in my experience, in my opinion, that assigning a particular gender to God has been tenuous over the church's history, has become heretical or even idolatrous at its worst. And we know that all people are created in God's image, meaning that the entire gender spectrum in some way reflects God's all-encompassing identity. But language can be limited in that way. We might not always have words to talk about that. We might not always have the proper pronouns that we need. And so on the other hand, I want to think about the positive aspect of this shepherd metaphor, especially in the first century, whereas today we have mass farming and, you know, all this kind of stuff, that in the first century we're thinking about the imagery of small flocks, the interdependence between shepherds and sheep, the intimate knowledge and affection that a shepherd might carry for his sheep. And I think that when Jesus summarizes all of that by saying, I am the good shepherd, that word meaning something more like beautiful, wonderful, I think that that picture of a shepherd intimately involved with his flock does still carry some meaning in our way that we might understand God. I don't know about you, but the part of this metaphor that gets me the most is the sheep part, the implication that as a part of God's people, I am somehow like a sheep. Because we spent some time, and this is a very limited experience, but when we went on the trip with the youth to Heifer Ranch, we spent some time with the sheep, and my main conclusions were that sheep are stupid and smelly. We, our task one day, which was one of the funnest days in my opinion, our task one day was to get the sheep into one of the littler, smaller pens so that they could check their hooves, hold onto them while they check their hooves and their eyes for different diseases and stuff. And so their instruction to us, I mean, I think Josiah was with me, right? Their instruction to us was simple, and maybe Caitlin, right? Were you with me that day? No, different day, okay. Our instruction was to go, they just told us, go out and get the sheep. And we're kind of like, we don't know what you're talking about. We've never gotten sheep before. And they basically just told us to kind of spread out behind them and start moving our arms, and they would all just go. They were really just that dumb. And so we did. We walked out there, and we kind of spread out along the fence, and we started kind of, and as soon as the first one looked up and kind of did the warning, like, they all just started running, and they all just, like, went right into the pen, and we closed it, and that was it. And then they're kind of like, oh, we're stuck. They're just not, my experience and what I hear, at least from other people, they're just not the most intelligent animals. And smelly, which kind of is another thing. But having myself, again, as a part of God's people or God's people as a whole compared to sheep is not my favorite thing. On the contrary, though, as I was kind of thinking about this and wondering about this, I did think about the ways that we can still get stuck in a herd or flock mentality sometimes. That sometimes God's people can be quite willful, sometimes for good, sometimes for ill. We can be quite smelly sometimes. But we can get into a mode where we're listening to particular voices that may not be the voice of God leading us. We heard some pretty loud voices on the national political scale over the past couple weeks, some of which might tend to lure us in a direction that is not the one God would have for us. Some of the ways that people respond to these different kinds of things do make me wonder if the sheep metaphor does still have some meaning for our own context. I won't get into too much detail on that. I have to admit that I haven't spent much time considering the gate imagery before. People tend to focus on the part about Jesus as a shepherd. But it does strike me as problematic that it can easily be heard as an exclusive image, that Jesus is somehow limiting the number of sheep that can be a part of this flock, that Jesus is somehow closing off access to God from certain people and not others. But I think the way that it's being used is actually much more positive and can be a meaningful image when it's understood in the way that Kenneth Bailey talked about shepherds who were traveling, laying down in the gate, in the opening in the sheep pen, to keep them safe from predators. The shepherds themselves sometimes function as the gate meant to keep predators out and sheep in. That Jesus, in comparing himself with the gate, is actually offering, saying he's offering the sheep a true life, he's offering safety from danger, from the other voices that might be had, but also offering the opportunity to go out in grace, to be free, to wander, and know that there was safety to return to at the end of the day. Oops, sorry. That in some ways, this metaphor, if a wolf attacked, as in the imagery that Jesus gives, that the shepherd might even be called to lay down his life for his sheep, for the sake of being able to offer a sheep the continued thing. And that gets into the distinction between hired hands, which I don't totally understand. But the idea that Jesus is so committed to God's people that he's willing to lay down his own life for them. Oops. I think I lost this. Can you give me a double click? Thank you. Oops. Oh, okay. Remember all that? Good. The last part of this metaphor that I want to address, the thieves, the wolf, the thief, strangers, brigands, barbarians, whatever Jesus is talking about here, that I think the limit of this particular metaphor is that we really need to be careful when Jesus points to perhaps the Pharisees who are still a part of the crowd, maybe the Romans who are around them, as thieves and implicates them in something that seems to be much more sinister when he narrows down on one particular thief that may be understood as Satan or something like that. That we don't ever want to be a part of condemning a group of people as representative of their race or religion. But that we might still understand that in this case, Jesus seems to be not condemning, again, these particular religious leaders on their own, but a kind of approach, the kinds of leaders whose voices would lead God's people away from the kind of life that God has for them. And I think that tends to be the still meaningful part, that we still have those kinds of voices present in our own world. That we experience forces at work that resist the kind of life that God has to offer us, the kind of freedom that God wants for God's people. Moving on to the father and son imagery, the major kind of positive thing in my mind about this particular image that Jesus shifts to at the very end of the passage, talking about God as a father and Jesus as a son. The major positive about this particular one, the way that it can be meaningful, is that it's so universal. All of us get this picture of a father and son because it's very everyday, ordinary kind of image. But in my mind, this is also the actual con, that all of us have some kind of an experience with a father figure at least. And so depending on our experience of that, the imagery of God as a father may bring different connotations to our mind. It may cause us to experience God in different ways. God is distant, cold, punishing. Oops, did I lose it again? I did. I lost it again. I'm sorry. I don't know what I'm doing here. Okay, we'll just go on. Sorry, I got a little lost here. I did want to address again how gendered this particular imagery metaphor is, that that the way Jesus is talking about this was a unique function of father-son relationships. In the case of shepherds, that the father would likely hand down the flock, care of the herd, just to a son and not to a daughter. But that parent-child relationships have changed over the last 2,000 years. They don't work quite the same way they did in the first century. But we can still look at the parent-child relationships we see around us and consider the ways that they might help us understand God or experience God. Okay. Oh, no. It's just tired. Okay. Can you click on the last slide? Or is it totally? Oh, no. Oh, okay. Well, whatever. You'll just have to remember the things. I want to move us into communion before too long, but coming out of that part, I do think there are things about the parent-child relationship that do speak to us of our relationship with God. The ways that parents have the flourishing of their children in mind at all times and will do whatever it takes to achieve that. The ways that God cares for us and wants what's best for us out of our lives. Wants a certain kind of, but also gives us will, gives us free will to be able to carry that out the way that we believe to be best. Moving into our time of communion, I just want to ask two questions to reflect on. The first is kind of has to do with the timeliness in the first century context of the shepherd and the father-son imagery. Is there new meaning for you to be found in the images that Jesus used? Do the images of God as a shepherd or as a good father extending abundant life to his flock or children speak to you? Oh, did that do something? Oh, no, okay. Oh, hey, I got it back. All right, yay. So the question of, is there new meaning to be found in these old images and metaphors? Once again, as we kind of think about them, as we try to hear them through the ears of the people who are listening to Jesus in the first century, they don't seem like very relevant images. Things have changed over 2,000 years. And at the same time, I believe there are things in there, as I was exploring this kind of what seems like a tired passage, found new things to hear about the way that Jesus experienced God, the way that Jesus was offering a way to experience God. But I also want to ask the question of, do these images provoke new ways of thinking of, talking about, or actually experiencing God in our everyday life? For me, it makes me think of God as the wind at Homer Lake, where I like to go on my Mondays off, speaking and moving gently, but only audible or visible when I slow down enough and get quiet enough to notice. It makes me think of God as a gardener, like Jim, patiently cultivating something delightful out of dirt, active and present, even when it appears that nothing is happening or growing. So maybe the limits to these particular images, metaphors, are too high for you, are too strong, and you can't quite get the same thing out of them that Jesus intended them to be, and that's okay. But maybe there are new ways that we might conceive of God working again in our everyday lives. God is intimate to us. God is wanting what's best for us. I invite you to reflect on those as we move back to the communion tables, which are open to everyone who would seek to experience, draw closer to God. I'll pray for us, and feel free then to move to the four tables around the back of the room as you feel led. We thank you for the ways that you are active in speaking in and through Jesus' ministry. We thank you for the ways that you are still active in speaking in and through us. We ask not only that we see and think and experience you in new ways from the images that we find in Scripture, but that also those provoke new ways of experiencing you, new ways of seeing you in our everyday lives, new ways of experiencing you as close to us as anything we know. We thank you for Jesus' willingness to lay down his life for your people. It's in his name we pray.